Welcome to Radio RSN. This is Dr. Tim McGinnis. Today we're conducting an interview of a fairly well-known individual in victim support circles. Her name is Debbie Montgomery. Debbie is a former military intelligence officer who herself was a victim of a romance scam. And without further ado, let me introduce Debbie to you. Debbie, welcome to Radio RSN.
Thank you so much, Tim. It's my pleasure to be here today.
Before we continue, I just want to advise that we are recording this interview so that we'll be able to play it back on our Radio RSN and other RomanceScamNow.com websites and Facebook pages for the benefit of other victims so that they can better understand exactly how romance scams and other types of scams work, and also the progression of recovery that other victims may be going through similar to what you yourself experienced. Do I have your permission to record this?
Yes, you certainly do.
All right, excellent. Debbie, if you could do me a favor, how long has it been since you discovered your scam?
It'll be 6 years in September.
Outstanding. Tell us a little bit about the circumstance, how you encountered the individual who ended up being the scammer, how this progressed, and a little bit more about yourself, if you would please.
Absolutely. My story obviously goes back beyond 6 years, and that was actually in 2010. I was married. I have four children. My youngest at the time was 15. The oldest was 23. I had one at home. I was working full-time as a treasurer for the Palm Beach County School District. I had left banking. I had been a bank manager for 6 years. You mentioned I had been in the Air Force. I was I was Air Force officer for 8 years, and then I stayed home to raise my kids. I went back to work as a bank manager when my husband was going over to Bosnia to work as a contractor for the Air Force, and I needed benefits. So I went to work at the bank and then got an opportunity to work in the school board. And in 2010, April 8th, 2010, I was at a meeting, and I got turned my phone off and listened to the meeting, came back out, and my phone was blown up with messages. And the very first one was from my oldest son, and he said, "Mom, Dad just died. I'm coming home to take care of everything." And you can imagine what was going through my mind at that point. The whole world was going through my mind. And I was thinking at that point, oh, my gosh, I've got to get home, because my youngest was 15, and I knew if I didn't get there to tell him what was happening, that with everybody in the high school having a cell phone in their pocket, if one person got a hold of it, it would have been all over Facebook, and I did not want Maddie to find out that his dad had died through a Facebook post.
So, I'm so sorry, by the way.
Oh, well, thank you. It's one of those things. He was 56 years old. We'd been married almost 26 years. And he was in good health, but not the best of health. And unfortunately, he had a sudden heart attack. And so in an instant, I was thrown into being a single mom, a widow, and I had to run his business, which I knew nothing about. So for 6 months, I worked at the school district. I ran our company. It's an online company. We manufacture vitamin supplement for diabetics. And all I was doing was I was working 20 hours a day, because I found that at night it was the hardest for me being alone. I didn't like to go to sleep alone. And I was mad at Lou for dying. I was sad. I was, went through all those emotions of grief. And I threw myself into work. And about 6 months into that, some of my friends were like, "Deb, you need a life. You need to do something more than work." And I was like, well, I'm not a partier. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I didn't see a way out for me to start what they wanted me to do, is start dating again. And they said, "Why don't you go into online dating? It's safe. You can do it from home, kind of like you can stalk from home. You could look at the profiles." And so I did that. I felt like, well, I've got a couple of friends that have met their husbands online. Why don't I just try it a little at a time? I had grown up, my mom, bless her heart, everything that I portrayed to the public, I wanted to make sure that I did it well. I did it perfectly. I wanted a perfect profile. I didn't want to look like I had too much baggage with the kids and everything that, you know, I love my kids, but, you know, to go
Certainly.
Out there at 52 years old with four children and all the stuff going on, I wanted to look good because I think the anxiety of when I was young, dating at 16, all flooded back in at 52 when you don't feel good enough, pretty enough, strong enough. And it's so silly because I was very accomplished academically and also career-wise, and I was looking better at 52 than at 16. So anyway, all those anxieties aside, I put my profile out there on a faith-based website. I thought, again, that would be safe. And I, you know, dipped my toe. Got a few guys responding back, and then one in particular, because you might find this interesting. I really found that men my age and a little bit older did not know how to write, did not know how to communicate, and the pictures they put on out on their websites were just, I thought, not for me. And so when I was contacted by a gentleman who was a widower from England, an international businessman, you know, that rang true to me. I have an international company. He'd been, you know, he lost his wife. That also resonated with me. I found the guys that at the time that were divorced spoke differently about their past relationships, where the guys that were widows kind of understood where I
sure.
was coming from with a sudden loss. So anyway,
sure.
my gentleman's name was Eric Cole. Eric was from England. He was 55. He was a father of one little boy. And he wrote to me, and it was interesting. And looking back, the very first long conversation we'd had through Yahoo Chat. And well, here's the first thing. We were on the website for a while, and then he said, Deb, you know, I'm getting ready to travel overseas. At the time, he was in Houston. I'm going overseas. I want you to move over to Yahoo Chat. Well, I didn't know much about Yahoo Chat, so he walked me through setting it up. And for me, it was kind of fun because it was instant messaging. When we were talking, it wasn't write an email and wait. You know, it was just instant gratification. So
Certainly.
We were on Yahoo Chat. And would speak, well, speak, when I say speak, we would write, chat online for hours and hours and hours. And that, for me, was very safe because it gave me something to do when I was home alone. Also, I think after Lou dying, I wasn't ready for someone to be here physically. So just, it was what I felt was safe. And it also allowed me an opportunity to just put my life out there and write, because I found I was so much more articulate in writing than speaking at the time about feelings and all that. So it allowed me, it was really therapy. It turned out to be really good therapy. So that went on for about 2 years. And yes, I had the ups and downs. He was supposed to, this was in October, November. He was supposed to come here for Christmas, and we'd made plans for him to come over and visit with my family, and that fell through. And of course, you know, you have the high of being, you know, noticed, and it's like when you're 13, 14, 15, and you have that first love, the butterflies and all that excitement, and then you have that, and all of a sudden he wouldn't get here, and my heart was crushed, and I would try to understand why he couldn't get here. And so that was the story for a couple of years, which I look, you know, you look back and it's 2020, but in the process, it was everything that he said to me about why he couldn't get here sounded plausible. And
he was someone who was British and residing in the UK. And where was he working?
He was, at the time, he got a job in Malaysia. He was actually brokering hardwood trees between Malaysia and India. Very interesting that I had investments in trees, in hardwood trees in Costa Rica, and I didn't have that anywhere on my profile, so it was just either coincidental or I don't know how he would have found that out if he even did, but so his business rang true to me because I kind of understood it. And the interesting thing, you know, my intelligence background, I was a little bit skeptical at first, but then I contacted the company he worked for. He had a beautiful website. And when I asked them if he worked for them, they said, well, no, he doesn't. And so then I start thinking, well, maybe he's a contractor independent and he's not actually on their employee list. So every time I tried to find out something specific about him, if it didn't come back right or true, then he'd always have an answer for why it wasn't happening. And again, I was so trusting. I just believed everything that was being said because I was being honest in whatever I was saying.
Right, and projecting onto him the same.
Absolutely, and I had high hopes that it was all going to be great because everything he said was the right thing to say. And, I mean, I wasn't going into it blindly, but at some point my heart just overtook my head. And
right.
I trusted and believed everything that he was saying to me. And when I questioned, like I said, whenever I questioned something, he always had a plausible reason for why it either didn't happen or, you know, why he couldn't get here. And, you know, that was my life. But it was okay at the time because I could understand. And then it went on for quite a long time. But when we talk about scams, obviously the audience here has been scammed at some point. The first time he ever asked me for money was very little. And he had a friend who was also in business overseas, and he was having a hard time getting onto the website. So they asked me to just help him get a membership on the site, which I had to send a check in. And I did. It was maybe $45. I don't remember. But I figured, well, what the heck? You know, put a few more men on the list might not be a bad thing. So I did that. And then the next thing that happened, you know, there was a tariff problem or a customs issue. And I understood that because, I mean, I have an international business, and I know that sometimes you don't get paid for the job until it's completed. And so,
hang on one second.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you paid a fee for a website. That was for a dating website?
It was a dating website, and I sent a check into them.
What's important about that is this is one of the mechanisms that scammers use to get verified profiles on dating website, which you can't get unless you pay. So on many of the dating websites that are out there, the only criteria that they have for verification is that you pay. The minute you pay, they'll indicate that your profile is either verified or that you're a paying member, which conveys that the website trusts you, and as a result, it opens the door for a much easier scam of other individuals, unlike unpaid profiles.
Interesting.
And unfortunately, victims pay on behalf of the scammer, the scammer's friends. So a single individual can be responsible for paying for anything from one to a dozen different profiles. Of course, today, dating websites are not the dominant way in which scammers introduce themselves. It's social media of one nature or another. Sorry, please continue.
No, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Again, I was so naive to this whole thing because I hadn't been in the dating world for over 20 years. And so, again, I trusted everything that he was saying to me. And when I didn't, and there were times when he would give me an address, I sent a package to his sister who was living in the London area with his little boy, and I sent a package to them, and it got returned. And I asked, why? And he goes, well, maybe she's traveling. He always had some good answer. And I actually, because I was an imagery analyst in the Air Force, I would look at Google Earth. I would look at the address he gave me. I would look at it from an imagery point of view and say, couldn't that be the house? And I rationalized.
Was it something he asked you to send, or was it something you spontaneously sent?
It was something I spontaneously sent. I found out that it was a birthday coming up,
okay.
Or I had gone up to Cape Canaveral to see the space shuttle, and his little boy was really interested in science, so I had sent a postcard and whatever. So, no,
sure.
He did not. And the other thing, at another point in time when he was in I guess it was Kuala Lumpur for quite a long time, or maybe Hong Kong. He was in the Far East. I sent a package to him at the hotel he told me he was at, and it got returned. And so I was actually in contact with the head of the hotel, the manager of the hotel, and I'm like, my boyfriend is in room 30 whatever. And he wrote back. He goes, I'm really sorry, Mr. Montgomery. He's not there. And so I'm like, Eric, where are you? I'm in contact with the manager. And he would say that he had either moved or he was with a friend or, whatever. And so there were times when I, got these things back and questioned. And, again, he always gave me an answer. There was not a skip in the beat here. He always came back with a reason why things hadn't happened. So one thing led to another. And, over 2 years, I gave him a substantial amount of money. more than probably most people, and I've got to put it out there right off the bat, I did not have the money to give to him in a savings account, in a checking account. I was so invested emotionally in our story, in our romance at that point. It was like any family member of mine, if they had asked me to help them out, I would do whatever I could to help them out. And
sure.
So when Eric was in these really drastic spots, you know, I cashed in retirement accounts thinking that we would, you know, there's a period of time that you can take money out of an account and put it back in before you get a penalty. And so I did that. I did that on multiple retirement accounts. I had silver that I was keeping as an investment. I sold silver. I got to the point where I, you know, was hawking my old diamonds, and I'm thinking, oh, this isn't right, and I certainly was never going to lose one of those. So I always got my rings back, but I've had extra gold that I sold, and it was unbelievable, you know, what I did to help.
Would you share the total amount that you lost in this?
Absolutely. It's pretty well known out there now. I lost $1,080,762.43. Not all at once. That was over a two-year period, and it was started off little and, you know, went to Western Union for $2,500. And then I think the biggest things that I sent over might have been $100,000 wires through Bank of America.
So many people have a hard time understanding how that's even possible. But based upon everything that I've learned over the 28 years I've been involved in observing online fraud, is it's sort of the Chinese curse of 1,000 cuts. It starts off small and it's incremental. And after a certain point in time when logically you would be questioning your sanity, you have so much invested in it that almost your mind refuses to allow you to question it, because to do so sort of risks the entire scenario that you've built up so painstakingly for yourself around this phantom relationship.
That's exactly what happens. And you think, oh, just one more, and it'll all be over. And
right.
The hardest thing for me out of that whole $1 million, 100,000 of it, I actually got from my parents, because we were so close to getting him here, and we had something, you know, something was stuck in Mexico, and I didn't have the extra 100,000, and I my parents knew all about this. And, you know, I think at some point if you asked my father, he would say that he questioned and thought maybe it was a scam. But 2 years in, my dad's like, nobody could lie to us for 2 years. And so he and my mom helped me out. And when this all, you know, fell apart, I didn't worry about anything but the 100,000 that I owed my parents, and that has weighed heavily on me in the last 6 years, to the point that, you know, any extra money that I had, and my father works for me now. He's a retired dentist. He's 88 years old. I take care of as much as I can for them because of that sense of responsibility and angst that I caused them.
Certainly.
Even though they would say, you know, the golden lining of all that, the silver lining of all that, is I have an extraordinarily close relationship with my parents, which could have gone the other way, because here's one thing I do find about the scammers is that they tend to isolate you from your family and your friends.
And deliberately so.
That happened to me. I actually, you know, had it out with my older boys, who kept saying, Mom, don't do this, don't, you know. As soon as anybody said don't do something, it's like a two-year-old where he's like, hey, I'm the adult. Leave me alone. I want to do what I want to do. I never told my kids what happened. I never told my friends what happened. And when they questioned me, I really shut them out. And I regret that. Although I have, you know, patched that up with my kids, I find that very difficult. Though a lot of the women I deal with, I talk with now, they don't have a relationship with family or friends. And that's the hardest part, is being shunned or isolated from your family. Because if
Right.
you need them at any point, it's right now. It's the greatest need is right now, so that you're not going through this alone. And I've been very fortunate that, you know, I got blasted by my boys, but once we aired it and I explained to them how it could have happened, they're very supportive of what I'm doing now, and that I'm speaking out and I'm trying to educate people about how it happens. Because if anybody could, you know, if I can be taken as a trained banker and an intelligence officer, as a paralegal, I had all this great training. But if I can be taken, I feel like almost anybody can be taken. And as far as
almost anybody can.
Absolutely. When I went to the FBI and took all my bank records and everything with me, they'd never seen such extensive documentation. And the first thing they said is, we're sorry, we can't help you. And the second thing is, in Palm Beach County, more men are taken for over $1 million than women, but the men will never tell.
Exactly.
And that's the hard part, because this is such a huge problem, but people are afraid to talk. And that's what I wanted to tell everybody, is that you find power in your story. And I felt like once I was able to tell it, and this is another thing, it took me a couple of years before I even acknowledged to anybody that it happened. And I was sitting at a, I was going to a meeting, and I was there about, it was a speaker training, and I went to speak about my company, and I was having lunch with some friends, and somebody mentioned online dating, and I think I rolled my eyes at them, and they're like, oh, come on, you got to tell this story. And I'm like, nope, can't tell. They said, Deb, please tell us your story. And I did, and one of my friends took my hand, and she said, you have to tell your story. My mother was taken for $80,000, and she will never tell. And then someone else
came up. Yeah, this is one of the things that most people do not realize. I myself was in a meeting yesterday and explaining the purpose of the Society of Citizens Against Romance Scams, the nonprofit that I'm chairman of and founded. But the simple reality is that there were at least, if not more than, 1 million individual victims in 2016 alone. Virtually, we're in a state now where almost everyone in the United States, at least, knows someone who is a victim of a romance scam. They may not know that they know it, because the victim may not have communicated. We find that literally only about 3% of romance scam victims will report the crime. Maybe as many as 10% will share their experience with others, even in their immediate family and circle. But the vast majority of them are too ashamed, too embarrassed to even mention this. And you were mentioning men. The victimology of men who experience a romance scam is distinctly different than that of women in general. Women, we find, are able to recover from the experience, and while it may have an extraordinarily traumatic effect on their personality, on their ability to trust, etc., men more often are trapped in the rage that comes with the discovery that they have been scammed. Mm. Some of it is just pure the affront to their manhood. But more than that, men's reaction is quite different. Women, I suggest, have a more maternal approach towards the relationship that leads to scamming. Men have more of a knight in shining armor kind of a mentality as they go into these scams, because so frequently the scammers are using images of young women in desperate situations where the man needs to save them in one fashion or another, whether it's an ex-porn star who has retired to visit their mother in Ghana, which, of course, never happens.
Right.
And one of the great tragedies that we see is, of course, this happens with women who, while they're in the throes of the scam, are in total denial. Men, on the other hand, even after they have discovered the scam, still live in significant denial, who firmly believe that the face in the photo was the actual person that they were talking to, and that because of outside influences, outside actors, you know, a despicable manager, boyfriend, husband, whatsoever, they were trapped into this life, and if only they could escape it, etc. And even after they were scammed, the scammer continues the fiction, and they firmly believe that they're talking to that person in that story in Benin, Togo, Ghana, wherever it is in West Africa, etc.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about what you've been doing since the discovery of the scam, and tell us a little bit about the period that helped you recover from this, and what you did to help yourself from the point of discovery through to the point where you could talk about this?
Okay. Well, the point of discovery was the in September of 2012, and it was almost 2 years to the day that I had started the romance. And one morning he came online, and he said, "Deb, you know, how do you feel about forgiveness?" And we got into this long, long discussion online about how I felt about forgiveness, and it was for hours. And I'm a very spiritual person, so I pulled out all the stops on how I felt about forgiveness. And then we got disconnected, and that happened frequently, very frustrating. But you know, he was over in Malaysia, and so I kind of justified why we got disconnected. Came back on a few hours later and said, "Hey, do you remember what we were talking about?" "Yes, please explain." So I did over again. And I'm like, why all this talk about forgiveness? You know, have I done something, thinking that it was my fault? And he goes, "No." He goes, "I have something to tell you, and it's going to hurt you badly." And I'm like, "So are you sure you want to tell me?" And he comes back. He goes, "I have a confession to make." And when I heard that made me sick, because I'd only heard that once before in my lifetime, and it had to do with my husband. I'm sitting there watching him, you know, write this email about, or this conversation about this, you know, this confession. And he goes, "I have to confess to you." He goes, "I want your forgiveness, and I have to confess to you this has all been a scam." And at that point, I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, he's sick. Something's happened. What's wrong here? I'm like, "You're lying?" I accused him of lying about the confession. And I said, "You know, you're going to have to prove to me that this has been a scam." And so to my amazement, he said, "There's a camera on Yahoo chat, and I'm going to come on live." And I'm thinking, for 2 years I've asked you to Skype or come on live, and you told me that it's not available, and now you're going to show me? I said, "Okay, so show me." And so I have my screensaver is this picture of my handsome Brit, and I'm watching this little Yahoo chat camera come live, and I see this dark-haired, dark-eyed, dark-skinned young man with a big smile on his face. And in an instant, this was a gift from God, in an instant, my 2-year relationship with Eric was over. My intelligence hat kicked in. I'm sitting there looking at this young man going, "Oh my gosh, what has happened here?" Thank goodness I had my phone right beside me, my cell phone, and I took a picture of my screen. And I do have a picture of him, the real person. And so,
otherwise, you know, you might have questioned your sanity at that moment.
Absolutely, I would have thought, you know. And I'm very grateful that I got that picture, because I have a face to the scammer now. But I also had that closure that, you know, this guy was not my Eric. There might have been elements of his life and personality that, you know, over the 2 years had come out, because I don't know that they could lie for 2 years and not have some of the story true. But I was able to, in an instant, you know, think, "Oh, my gosh, how am I going to stop him? How am I going to get my money back? You know, what's going to happen?" And we had this long conversation about, you know, with you know, forgiveness comes retribution, and how is he going to pay me back? And he knew he couldn't do it right at the moment. He promised that someday he would, and I'm thinking, okay, Pollyanna me. Yeah, someday maybe you get a check, but whatever. You know, it's not going to happen today. So I asked him why he did it and why he's confessing, and, you know, he confessed that he had fallen in love with me and he just couldn't do it anymore. He was having this spiritual awakening that he didn't want to die or have something happen and then, you know, have to, I guess, meet his maker and say, "I really did a number on this woman."
So, I hate to say it, but we've heard that story countless times. It's what is part of what we refer to as a secondary scam, where they reach the point where they know they've gotten as much money as they possibly can get out of you normally. And then they'll try and see if by taking another tactic, and usually what we found is that this will be a different individual than you've actually been talking to who will step in and play this role. You mentioned that you couldn't believe that there couldn't have been some truth in the 2 years of chatting. Ironically, and there have actually been arrests. There's at least one individual in the United Kingdom that was arrested for writing scripts for one Nigerian cartel. We do know that a lot of writers around the globe are asked to write fictional profiles of business people, of individuals, of engineers, etc., that are then used by the scamming gangs or scamming cartels. So it's extraordinarily professional, and it does require preparation and consistency. And we have seen that in some groups it's very disorganized, and they'll forget what they talked about the day before and ask you to remind them again. In other cases, they maintain very detailed records of the victims that they're working. They're using contact management systems where they can keep call notes or records of calls so that they can refer back to them, or if other individuals step in, because scammers have to be available 24/7.
Yeah, because
victims are available 24/7. So they work in shifts. Usually an individual is worked by a minimum of two individuals, but in some cases we've heard that groups of as many as six individuals will work a victim. And in many cases there will be a female on the team, but the majority will be men, mm-hmm. Just so that they get a female's perspective on what's taking place and providing guidance, etc. We've seen in one scamming organization in Lagos where literally they work out of a 10-story building where they have benefits and an HR department. They have a corporate training department that scammers will go to supervisors or training to get guidance and tips and techniques on how to continue to manipulate the victim. So what happened in your particular case after the scammer confessed?
Well, I went right to the FBI, and my mom and dad came over. I called them, and honestly, you know, I'm so can be grateful for being scammed, or I am grateful that he came online and I saw him, because there were a couple of times when I actually talked to him on the phone and I heard the British accent. So again, it played into the story that was some credibility to me. But when he came online and I saw who he was, at that point, I was thinking, okay, what can I do to, you know, keep him engaged and all the stuff so that maybe we could find him? Well, the FBI said that wasn't going to happen unless I could bring him here. And I shut down. I stopped talking about it. I didn't tell my friends what had happened. Of course, they were like, where's he gone? It's been 2 years. And I said, hey, it just didn't work out. But once my friends got me to open up, and that weekend that I was at speaker training, I delivered the end of a talk, which invited everybody to a VIP dinner and the movie premiere of The Woman Behind the Smile. They're sitting there speechless, and they're like, "When's this going to happen?" I said, "You guys, I just made it up." And they're like, "No, this is going to happen. You're going to get out there and you're going to start to speak, and this is why ABCD." So at that moment, I was actually challenged. A friend of mine who is a former anchor for CNN in Atlanta was doing a cruise, and she wanted me to be a speaker on the cruise. But she said, you got to get your book done first. You've got to write that book, The Woman Behind the Smile. So I actually did. I wrote a book called The Woman Behind the Smile, Triumph Over the Ultimate Online Dating Betrayal. And it's out there on Amazon, and, you know, it's around the world. And one person at a time is reading it, and it's affecting change. And I, you know, I've taken on that role. I have this purpose now in my life that I want to educate women like myself and men, but mostly women, because I want them to know that it's educated, well-trained people that are being taken as much as anybody else. And yes, I was part of it, but my logical self, I mean, I'm one of those damn Yankees who very rarely gives money away, and so to see how I gave so much, I look back and go, how in the world could I do that? And it's one of those things. It's just your emotions take over, your heart leads your head, and I want people to realize that it happens every day, and it hurts my heart that it's still happening. I mean, I've been interviewed by CBS this morning. It was on, you know, a couple weeks ago. I've been interviewed by NBC. The Palm Beach Post did a whole feature article on it. And I've had just a few people that have come back and said, boy, that was really stupid of you. But for the most part, everybody understands that we're all vulnerable.
Well, I think we can all agree that, yes, it was stupid of you, but it doesn't mean that you are stupid.
Exactly, exactly. And
you know,
I look
we,
at my
we can,
life.
We can engage in a stupid activity without being stupid ourselves.
Exactly. But it's part of my life's quilt right now. You know, it's part of me. And I'm looking at it as positively as I possibly can, and like, what can I do? Because I've always felt like things happen to me for a reason in my life, and how can I make good out of the bad things, the tragedies, whatever, because it's all a learning experience, an opportunity for growth, and I've grown tremendously. And the one thing that I did find out now, a girlfriend of mine whose husband was a therapist said, Deb, we could have given you therapy for a lot less than $1 million, but my last suit has no pockets. I can't take the money with me. I need to make something positive out of this. And I do that by choosing to not let what happened drag me down, to not let what happened hold me back. It happened. It's over with. I can't change it. But I can change what's going forward now. I can change
yes.
the way I look at it. I can change the way other people think about it. I can make people aware that it's happening, and this is how good these guys are, and make them aware. And I've been doing that. Like yesterday, I had been interviewed by the Senate Select Committee on Aging for the hearing that they had yesterday. I didn't.
Yes,
go
tell us about that, please.
Well, it's really interesting because they're working a lot on fraud aimed at the elderly. Well, I'm going to be 60 this year, so I'm a member of AARP because I'm old enough. But what they're trying to do in the United States Senate, and you know, in agencies here, there's a local agency in Palm Beach called Agency for Aging. They're looking to educate as much as they can the folks that are being scammed. The IRS scam, you know, there's so many things out there that people are trying to do training. And they said, Deb,
right.
How can we stop what's going on? And I'm thinking, I have no idea if you guys can't figure it out. I said, but I think by making people aware of what's going on, for me, maybe speaking to senior citizen groups or women's groups and just say, guys, this is what is happening out there, because I think so many of us are so naive as to what's going on. Because I wasn't around people that, you know, were liars and scammers and cheaters. That's not the type of person I put myself around. But I also trusted in the system. I trusted in online dating. And it frustrates me that there's not a better way to detect these scammers. Because I have friends, men friends, whose pictures have been used by scammers for fake profiles. And
right.
So these guys are victims also. They're working with the FBI on the other side, you know, because they're getting called up by angry women saying, you're scamming me. And they're like, no, we're not. We don't know who you are.
Or worse, they're being stalked by victims
yes.
after the fact, because they're so connected with that face that they cannot let go, even when they realize the person that they've been talking to is not the face in the photo.
Exactly. And that's happened to very famous people.
Yes.
And so that's another side of the story. And I feel bad for my guy friends that this is happening to. And then it makes me question, how about my pictures? How about the stuff that I sent, you know, all those years? And then when
do you routinely do Google image searches of your own photos?
Well, I do, but it's hard because I'm out there now. You know, I'm out there speaking, and I'm out there with the media. And so my pictures are out there now. The ones I've seen are tied to legitimate causes. I haven't seen anything being used as scams. But it makes you question, you know, what happens.
Indeed.
And
indeed.
I think the thing that frightened – I wasn't frightened, but when I heard from your organization that they are possibly – the scammers are possibly tied to – terrorism or, you know, the Boko Haram guys. I mean, you just have to tell me that. And I was thinking, oh, my gosh, I would never have sent money. But, again, I didn't know he was in Nigeria. If I had heard Nigeria, if I had heard Africa, I mean, I'd done enough with scams and when I was working in the bank that would have been a trigger for me.
Exactly.
I didn't realize that England is used so much, or that Hong Kong, Malaysia, those places are – that whole side of the Far East that you've enlightened me about, I didn't know about that. And so that's
well, Malaysia is critical because it's the money laundering for the Nigerians. They literally put people on planes almost every day with suitcases full of cash. And the Malaysians, ironically, are rock stars when it comes to arresting scammers.
Yeah.
But they arrest them after the fact. Once they identify an individual who's scamming within their country, they will arrest them immediately because they have nothing but disdain for the Nigerians that have arrived in their country and the quote-unquote bad Muslims that they are. But in Africa, it's such an irony because the food chain in the scamming organizations go right up to the highest levels of government, and those same organizations are used to funnel money to Boko Haram and some of the other Muslim extremist groups within the region, and you have scammer groups that are funneling money to the terrorists, who then in turn raid Nigerian communities, kidnap young women, kill Nigerian soldiers and police, terrorizing the entire northern part of the country, running as far as Malawi, etc. And it's an endless circle. And one of the things that most people don't know, but you might have been aware of this being an intelligence officer, is that prior to 9/11, that Al-Qaeda's funding mechanisms included online fraud, and to this day, still apparently are running online fraud out of places like Tunisia, the United Arab Emirates. There's significant active scamming going on directly from Iran itself, and it's a never-ending cycle. I personally shut down a scamming group in Afghanistan just after 9/11 that was engaged in a plot to assassinate the Dutch queen. But this goes on and on and on, and it is a cultural problem, but it is a global problem, right behind global drug trade in terms of the volume of money involved. It's it's right up there with drugs, online global fraud, human trafficking, and terrorism in terms of the four largest crimes on a global basis. One question. Were you able to utilize the casualty loss that you incurred to get some of your money back on your taxes?
I did. Actually, I worked very closely with my accountant and was able to do that. And I also submitted a claim to Western Union. And I've actually gotten a couple other women that have been scammed to do the same thing. And so they took advantage of that, and especially with the extension for filing.
Yes.
If there are people out there that still haven't done that, it's worth trying to, you know, fortunately I had all my records together. It was very easy for me to do. But thank goodness.
As a result of the government shutdown, we lobbied pretty heavily with the FTC to extend the deadline, and we're pleased that they, in fact, did that.
Well, and, you know, I don't expect to get much of it back, although it would be nice to get a little bit back, just to show that, I mean, when I heard, too, that it was possible that some of the owners of Western Union shops in Malaysia were part of the scam, thinking, oh, my gosh, that is so not right.
And, Western Africa as well.
Oh, yeah, and that's, of course, that's where the stuff that I sent went to Malaysia. And,
right.
I questioned that, too. I'm like, Eric, why am I sending it to these guys? Oh, they're my friends, and da-da-da. I'm like, okay, so silly me. I'd never sent a Western Union gram out before in my life, so I felt like a criminal doing it at first. And he's like, no, it's okay. And thinking, oh, I don't like this. It made me uncomfortable, but I did it anyway. So hopefully I get a little bit of that $1 million back because part of it at the very beginning was done through Western Union. But here's the thing. When I went to the banks after the fact, and, you know, as a former banker, really, I thought there was better security when people are doing wire transfers, at least when I was in banking. And when I went back to, it was actually Bank of America, they're like, we're sorry, Deb, but all those accounts are most likely closed. And, you know, once we wire the money out, it's your problem, and we can't do anything about it. And I'm thinking, there's got to be something in the banking community where they can protect us a little bit better. And I did hear that on the hearing yesterday at the Senate, was that there was a bill that is allowing now the banks or the tellers or whoever to be a little more aware of what's going on, and they're able to report it. Because I know it's a privacy issue, but it's a protection. For me, it's a consumer protection issue, that if I, as a banker, was watching someone to come in and send, you know, $50,000, $100,000, $10,000 wires out to crazy places over and over and over, that history would have been such a red flag to me. And even though I knew my way around the banks, and when someone started to question me, I would go to a different branch. I was pretty savvy on that. Most people would not do that. They would be scared stop. But I would
definitely about
training in.
Question about your experience with the FBI. Can you go into more detail about what they told you when you reported the scam?
Well, I'm a little frustrated with the whole thing, because part of my whole stand-up series is seek out the authorities and tell. And when you go there, I've heard this from multiple people, is that they're not quite sure how to take what you're telling them. They don't know exactly what to do. I mean, when they listen to me, it's like their jaws are on the floor. They couldn't believe what had happened, and I had all the documentation. And when they said that there's nothing that they could do, but they did want me to report it to ICE. They wanted me to put it on their internet crimes file report.
The IC3,
to put it in there as so they can collect a database. And again, this was 6 years ago. And I'm hoping that something has come out of that. But they said to me at the time, unless I was able to get them here to the United States, they wouldn't be able to help me do anything about it. And so I'm I'm not going to Nigeria. although I had a lot of men in my family that were ready to fly there. There was nothing that I could do at that point. And they were very kind about it and helped me get through the reporting. But when I suggest to people that they do report it to the authorities, I don't know that I've had anybody that's had a really positive experience yet. And that's frustrating. There's got to be some training on their part to understand, how to deal with
We are working on that. As you're aware, SCARS is in partnership with the Department of Homeland Security through their cybercrime and victims awareness program. And we're also partners of the Department of Justice, particularly through the National Centers for Victims of Crimes. The level of training is improving gradually over time. One of the things that's changed dramatically in the last couple of years within the FBI is that as a result of the shift towards business email compromise scams, the FBI has become acutely more aware of the financial losses that are incurring, because businesses generally report while romance scam victims do not.
Right.
So we've seen the number of loss or the amount of losses in the BEC scam arena grow into the tens of billions in just 2 years.
Wow.
But it is true that the FBI is generally powerless. And part of the problem that victims have when they go to report this is people live in a relatively pampered world in the United States and in Western Europe, parts of Asia as well, is that we believe that when we go to the police will take action, ignoring the fact that these criminals are in countries where, as long as they're not scamming the locals, generally it's not even considered much of a crime. And the local governments are so appreciative of the hard currency that's coming into their country, they're not going to do anything about it. There is no way on earth that the government of Ghana is going to arrest thousands of their youngest and brightest, many of whom are college graduates inside of Ghana, for romance scams. The same is true of Nigeria.
Yep.
Scamming may very well be the number three industry, maybe even the number two industry, in Nigeria, right behind petroleum.
Mm-hmm.
So without effective treaties, which generally don't exist to address this, the FBI is exactly right. Now, the advantage of reporting this, and we always encourage reporting on three levels. We encourage reporting at the local police level, and go in knowing that the local police are going to do nothing. It's an informational report And the reason is that under certain circumstances, you can claim this as a casualty loss on your homeowner's insurance or your business insurance and receive recovery in that way. We also recommend that you file a complaint with the IC3 and or the FTC so that the government will have the information. Unfortunately, most victims have no idea who actually scammed them. They only have a fake name. So that information is, for all intents and purposes, useless unless that fake name crops up in multiple victims and each victim has another piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. But we were so frustrated by this that in 2015, we invested a significant fortune in the development of a global reporting system that allows for hundreds of locations where reports can come in. It all goes into a central data clearinghouse and data repository model and then is distributed out to authorities around the world, as well as dozens of websites, scam data aggregators in the United States and Europe that work with dating websites, etc., as well as to social media. You see these appearing, for example, as our COBALT reports, which are the immediate threat reports when an individual encounters a new scammer that's sending them essentially a friend request or a contact request. That word can get out literally instantaneously. You put in a report on something like anyscam.com, and within a minute, it's appearing around the globe, not only displayed on Facebook pages, but into dating websites, etc. But really, it is the lack of hard data that has been the biggest hindrance. Phone numbers are extremely scarce, so those tend to be reused countless times, or reused over and over across a multitude of names and email addresses. Email addresses are easy to produce. And in fact, one of the things that we desperately need in the way of new legislation and treaties around the world is identity verification for email addresses. We've mm-hmm. reached a point where anonymity is the enemy of safety online. And even though it promotes freedom of speech is being destroyed by both scammers themselves in stealing identities, as well as everyone from Google to Facebook, etc. So it is a real challenge, but as we go forward, these mechanisms are being expanded to create watch lists. So when there is a real name associated with a scammer, that's put on watch lists. And when these scammers cross borders, they're being apprehended going into Britain, going into the United States. And while it's not a huge number, I'm proud to say that in 2017, we hope partly as a result of some of SCAR's activities, we saw a multi-thousand percent increase in arrests of scammers around the globe. Whereas, yeah, it would be measured in single digits per month in 2016. In 2017, it was every single day relentless, even though it didn't make it into the news media much.
Well, what I'd like to see, I mean, we'd like to take care of things after the fact, but I'd like to see a little more prevention, and especially on the sides of the online dating sites. And I know that they're big businesses, and they may think we're just a gnat in the whole scheme of things, but, you know, perhaps there needs to be something more than the little disclaimer at the bottom of the website that says, you know, be careful, don't go off the site. Because when I reported it to my dating site, they basically said, "We'll block the guy. There's nothing we can do." And I'm like, "Well, that's not very good." Because, you know, you get someone that's in their 50s, they're coming onto the site trusting that it's going to be a fun site, that it's a good thing, and there may be it might be to their benefit if they put up there, "Hey, be careful, and this is why. This can happen. It does happen, and if you stay in proper channels, it won't happen, or it may not happen." But there was no kind of warning to me and to folks that I've talked to about the possibility that this happened. And, I mean, it's just like since I've been more aware and can get out there, I see it all the time now. But before, I was so, you know, naive to what was going on. And I don't know that
part
they,
of this is
they
the
really
law.
Know how much. Well, you've said that. Maybe you can get into that a little bit because I don't think that a lot of people will report it again. So they may not know how many people are being scammed from their sites. But if you could explain
that,
could you tell me a little bit about that once, about the federal law that protects them?
Right. They know, but they have to, because of their own liability considerations, turn a blind eye. We'd like to see, and have been working through DOJ, and hopefully we'll be able to do so with Congress, that the law, which is the Communications Decency Act of 1997, will be amended so that these sites are liable once they're notified, because they're not engaged in the kind of proactive measures. Let me give you an example of this. Match.com gets notified of a scammer. So what do? They block that particular profile. They will block the email address. They won't block the IP address. So the result is, scammer just creates a new email address. He's right back on Match.com within a matter of a couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. What we need to be doing as an industry, and my own involvement in that goes back into the mid-2000s, what the industry must be doing is much more aggressively blocking and giving members control to be able to block profiles that need to be blocked. For example, if you sign up for a dating website, you should be able to block everyone from specific countries and everyone who uses proxies or VPNs, because you have no way of verifying exactly where that person is. You should only be able to see people who have verified profiles in specific localities. But those kind of mechanisms are not employed. Literally, Facebook just started talking about its plan to use facial recognition, which we're not even sure they're going to use it to block duplicate and fake profiles. Because Facebook has different interests than consumer safety. We've seen that over and over. Just look at the number of times you have to report a scammer stolen profile before they actually will take action. It's an interesting experience. One of the areas that might lend itself in terms of the best way of reaching the public before they are scammed is to focus on teens and young adults, because the reality is they are being scammed at an even higher level than the elderly are. We've published our guide, which is available on our Facebook pages as well as our website, to family interventions, because the elderly tend to have, and of course, I don't mean that in a derogatory way given your age or my own, but the elderly tend to have the greatest difficulty accepting that they're being scammed, both men and women. And family members can see it quite clearly, but they don't know how to act. And that is a real challenge. So anybody listening to this, I would encourage you to take a look at our family intervention guide, which provides some guidance on approaches that you can take when you have a family member that you see is being scammed, but they won't believe it. But teens and young adults, I believe, are one of the most vulnerable categories, and also the category that is easiest to reach, because they are easily reachable both through their peer communities as well as through online mediums, and have an inherent understanding of how unsafe the web could be. Yet this is also the same crowd that eats Tide Pods, so go figure.
Yeah. Well, and I worry about the kids because of their personal safety and what they're putting on their phones. And I look around here and some of the, 13, 14-year-olds who are maybe playing soccer at the local high school have their profiles out there and their locators. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, if anybody really wanted to find those kids, it would be so easy. And so I've talked to some of the parents saying, you've got to be careful, because we want to give the kids these phones so they can keep in touch with us. But we're not looking at their personal safety, and that's really tough. So it's a whole other thing.
During your scam, or rather when the scam ended, were you ever threatened by the scammer?
No, not at all. I mean, he was very, if you can be kind, he was very kind to me. And
okay.
And I have
So to wrap up, is there anything else that you'd like to share with the audience?
I just want people to be aware and to be careful, and to know that to speak up is very empowering, and it really helped me to heal. When I told my story and I had so many friends that would just give me a hug or take my hand and say, you know what, we understand how it could have happened, and we want to help our moms or our sisters or whatever. And there's only been one person that kind of gave me what I call the stink eye. And I was thinking to myself, okay, madam, you know, something's going to happen to you someday and you're going to understand. But I have been embraced by everybody that I've told the story to. So I really encourage folks to not feel that embarrassment, that it'll stop you from moving on, because the best way to get over this is to acknowledge it, own it, and then say, I'm not going to give them power over me anymore. I'm taking my life back, and I'm going to be positive about whatever's happened. You can't change the past, but you can change the future. And take it one
Absolutely.
Step at a time. One step at a time.
Absolutely.
So, thank you so much.
Would you like to go ahead and mention your book on Amazon and tell the audience where they can find it?
Sure. It's on Amazon.com, and it's called The Woman Behind the Smile, Triumph Over the Ultimate Online Dating Betrayal. And it's got a picture of me on the front. You can't miss it. And it's not all about online dating. It's basically on, you know, how this could have happened to someone that was, you know, had the experience that I had. And it's a story of all of us that want to put up that mask of perfection and then hide behind it. And sometimes we just have to drop the mask and open up and be a little bit vulnerable and say,
of course,
hey, you know, this is life. So.
Of course. And of course, of course, you also have a new dedicated anti-scamming page on Facebook called Love Bombs as well. So people can do a search for Love Bombs in Facebook and find your page.
That is brand new, so there will be stuff going on it soon. Because I think I just want to put stuff out there that is enlightening and educating and that will help people out. And I think that's what we need to do. So stress the positive.
Very good. And, of course, Debbie is a member of the Society of Citizens Against Romance Scam Scars, and we thank you for that. So let me conclude. This has been a presentation of Radio RSN. RSN is RomanceScamsNow.com, the Scam Avoidance Education and Victim Support and Assistance Division of the Society of Citizens Against Romance Scams Scars. For more information, you can learn about SCARS or to become a member at www.againstromancescams.org. And this recording is copyright 2018, the Society of Citizens Against Romance Scams, Inc. If you wish to comment, this recording will be available on the Society's Facebook pages. Or you can contact us either through our websites, which includes RomanceScamsNow.com, as well as AgainstRomanceScams.org, or any of our Facebook pages, particularly the RSN main page or the SCARS main page. Thank you, Debbie, for sharing this information, your incredibly powerful story, and your own recovery from your experience with us.
Well, thanks. It's been my pleasure, and I'm here to help.
Excellent. Thank you for your time, and this will conclude our interview.
Great. Have a great day.